Greetings, Podcats. This is Catherine Mary welcoming you to episode 7 of this podcast, Midstar No Bits. Thank you very much for downloading and listening. As I seem to say every week, but I really mean it, please tell one friend and encourage them to listen to the podcast. I'm finding that podcasts are still quite a new thing to a lot of people, and they haven't entered the wonderful world of free audio that there is out there. So as well as introducing them to this, me and my little show, you could introduce them to other shows as well. You can subscribe via iTunes or any of your other podcast subscribing systems, Podcatcher and the like. I always post the show on Facebook, and you can just listen to it there if you want. So it's quite easy to share the show. I'm really grateful for every new listener we have. In the meantime, let's pod. Here I go again, off down the road again, thinking I'm dreaming, days gone by. Catherine Mary here, welcoming you to episode 7. And oh my lord, I just had to come out from under my cozy blanket to record this little chat with you, because I've started my new job, which I'm loving. I can now tell you properly that I am thrilled to be an employee of Who Made Your Pants? Check them out, whomadeyourpants.co.uk. I'll put them on the show's website and you can have a look. But yep, we make and sell pants. But I don't know, two mornings in learning new things in a new environment with new people, just wiping me out. So I got home, had a little lemon sip, and went under a red blanket and just came out about half an hour ago. So that's exciting. So what's going on with you? Anything new in your world for 2014? There's quite a lot of music going on for me. I'm rehearsing with a lovely bunch of fellow ukulele players that I don't often get to play with. I think we're called Cool Hand Ukes, but there's so many ukulele pun names that I forget which band I'm in on any particular day of the week. Anyway, this is for a gig that's coming up in about 4 or 5 weeks' time, so we're well ahead of the game. Fascinating set list, including To Dream the Impossible Dream, To Fight the Unbeatable For... Well, we won't be singing it quite like that, but it's one of those songs which I thought I knew, and then when you come to sing it, you realise there's a wonky bit in the middle and you don't actually know the tune of it at all. People have been sharing versions with me. Roger Whittaker, what a pile of old pants. Who else was there? Shirley Bassey, of course. A range of different performances that I've been looking at. Whitney did it, but she's so many trills and rolls and foldy dolls that you can't actually hear the tune very, very well to actually learn it. So I'm doing that. I'm also been invited to join some very old mates who, as far as I'm aware, have not played music together since we were all about 15, which is many a long year ago now, I'm here to tell you. Anyway, one of them reached out to me and suggested that I might like to consider being their featured vocalist. What does this mean? Who knows? So I'm just sitting by and waiting now until I get summoned to come and waggle my tonsils in their general direction. What else has been going on? Oh, the nicest time at the moment is to be had walking my dog, because it seems like the puppies are out. Did everybody get a puppy for Christmas? I think I had the most wonderful 101 Dalmatians moment the other day when I was walking along the path and met a couple walking their red setter puppy Mabel. And it was only when I walked along a little further that I discovered that Mabel was out with six of her brothers and sisters and her mum and dad. So that's 9 red setters, 7 smallies and 2 biggies, all gambling about in the sunshine, being quite delicious. My dog, of course, believes himself to be a hippopotamus, so likes to writhe in water. I can't imagine. I suppose it's just sort of cooling or something. He doesn't have to be in it very long. He rushes up, lies down, rolls around, and then runs off again. I don't really get what it is going on for him, but it makes him extraordinarily happy, which is an incredibly good thing. The other delightful thing being out on a bright winter morning is saying good morning to old ladies and gentlemen. Morning. Morning. Morning, lovely weather. Morning. Morning. I love doing it. I love it. You see, in my heart, I think, oh, I'm reaching out to... Perhaps these people have had no conversation with any human being in the last week, and I am the only person to reach out to them, because, of course, that makes me feel good. Probably, really, they're the, chair and treasurer of the local bondage society, and they're having a perfectly lovely, busy life. But just a little nod, a little smile as you walk past. I enjoy it. I don't do it with younger people, though, because I feel like I'm not convinced that they know what the nodding and smiling etiquette is, what the rules are. So I'm going to nod and smile, and I'm just going to look like some crazy old winking lady. So, I'm quite selective on who receives my nodding and winking loveliness. The new job is fantastic. It is absolutely mentally exhausting. Thank God it's only 3 hours, because I think if I did any more, my brain might explode at the end of the day. There are spreadsheets and systems and sales reports and cups of tea and visitors and phone ringing and... Though apparently I'm fantastic when I answer the phone. I was told today that was giving people great pleasure to listen to me being generally bossy on the phone. One of my special skills, being generally bossy in any situation. And also, since I last spoke to you, I have had a gig at my very own house, which was wonderful. My good friend poet Angela Chicken performed some of her poetry, and then Grant Charkey played us some tunes live with his stand-up bass. Of course, it turned into a massive session, didn't it? People bring a bottle, and I don't know. I remember in my sort of 20s that you'd bring a bottle, but still about 11 o'clock, people were scrabbling around trying to find more drink, and is the off-license open, and can we get any more? But these days, I guess, we drink a bit less, but people bring the same amount, so there always seems to be tons left. And I've got all sorts of little cans of beer and lager and half bottles of wine and things kicking about, which I'll make plenty good use of over the next few days, I'm sure. So yeah, that was nice, but of course it meant that I absolutely had to recover, which is just takes so bloody long these days, doesn't it? How did we ever do it where we drank ourselves stupid and then just maybe even didn't go to bed and then, you know, went to work the next day and functioned and probably popped into the pub after work to have a little drink. Amazing how the body changes over time. Which kind of leads me into introducing my interview this week, which is with a fantastic guy called Steve White. Steve is an artist. He is mainly a painter, I think, but I've seen him do other kinds of work, but mainly paintings. I have one in my very own house of an enormous moon, which really does look like the moon in photographs. It seems to sort of glow off the canvas. Steve, well, we've all kind of had difficulties in life, haven't we? But some people were born into shittier circumstances than others, and blimey, Steve did not get the best chance to make an easy path for himself in the world. And so we talk long and hard about his journey from being a, you know, deprived kid in the north of London, born in the probably in the late 60s kind of thing, I'd have think, through a life which during which time he became an alcoholic, and with various other sorts of addictions running alongside it, and through which art and art school and friends and moving to a new city have transformed his life. And he seems to be in a really good place now. So that was great, because I've known Steve for a while, and all, he's pretty frank with, you know, sharing stories of his life. He doesn't try and hide it, but it was an opportunity to flesh out some of the stories and get some of the real meat, the real atmosphere of his life, which is, as I say, is pretty interesting. So I hope you enjoy it. Here's my conversation with Stevie White.
Imagination is more important than knowledge. Do you know what? Actually subscribe to that.
Imagination is more important than knowledge. So, when I first met you, Steve, mm-hmm. you were a student, even though you are a grown-up person, and you were doing fine art. Painting, I think you were. Correct, yeah. Weren't you? You were painting. And then, the little I know about you, you came to painting quite late in life. It's not something you've always done. So can you tell me a bit about how you started painting?
Okay. It's the end of a long story, really. But to cut a long story short, I was in Bournemouth recovering from alcoholism and substance various abuses of things. And I wondered what I'd do with myself. And so I went to Bournemouth College for a life drawing class to fill in a bit of time. And when I was there, I had a chat with a guy, and Andrew Peasley, his name was, brilliant man. And he said, "Well, you know, why don't you come and do the foundation,
college the wonderful foundation thing that is a foundation course that doesn't exist anymore, really."
Yeah, I know. The one at Bournemouth and Poole College has just been disbanded.
Wonder how many people foundation years have saved.
Yeah.
Over the years.
Yeah, absolutely. You know. It just opens you up to a whole new world. Yeah. And so he said, "Come and join us." This was without a portfolio. Yeah. All I said to him was, "I know that I can draw. And that's basically it. All I need to do is I want to kind of explore that. That's all I wanted to do."
So can I take you back a little bit? Mm. So getting from being in a some sort of... Was it actually rehab at this point? Or was it more of a, you know, the bit after rehab?
Yeah.
You're going to try and live out on the world on your own
This was 2006 that I went to see Bournemouth and Poole College.
Yeah.
I left rehab in September 2004. And I chose to go and live in Bournemouth.
Right.
Because a disaster hadn't happened to me in Bournemouth. Right. And I thought, what a nice new place to start.
Right, just go and start a new
by life. The sea. And to start with, that was a bit difficult. Upheaval and change, I don't do that well.
Yeah.
Met a couple of people. I've got a friend who I've had since that time. She's just one of my better friends I've ever had in my world.
Yeah.
And so I go down and see her every now and again. But yeah, there was something about that. Is this what my existence is going to be? Yeah. You know, that I've just moved into this new space to get away from what it was.
Right.
And I'm going to do nothing with it. You know, because that was... it was becoming monotonous, you know, that I was doing nothing. I was kind of unemployable. Some things about pressure and responsibility I still find a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah.
And so I kind of didn't know what to do. And being in that learning environment at that time, it suddenly was going into a glove that fitted perfectly or a shoe that fitted.
So life drawing, because I mean, life drawing is a leap for many people. Mm. I mean, even people who would count themselves as artists or whatever already. The idea of going and taking a bit of charcoal and drawing people with no clothes on.
Mm.
I mean, from being a London geezer who'd, you know, gone to the drink and fighting that battle, why life drawing, for God's sake? Of the million and one things you could have chosen?
It wasn't so much life drawing. I just knew that I could draw. I used to sit in front of the telly as a small child.
Right.
All I would do was draw things off the telly to get away from everything else that was going on around.
Oh, really? Yeah. What were you drawing? Tell me what you drew.
This is a bit weird to say, but I used to draw horses from the horse racing.
Yeah?
My father introduced me to gambling when I was four.
Oh, God.
Or something, yeah, which tells a story of its own. And I just used to draw horses all the time. Horses, horse racing. It was all about horses. And I see a horse now, and they're just majestic. I love them so much.
That's amazing. Mm. That's you haven't got any of that still, have you?
I haven't, no. I mean, intermittently, within like different stop-start parts of my world, there's been people who have found out that I can draw things.
Yeah.
I had friends in Leytonstone in the early part of the noughties, I think they call them, got me to draw their cats.
Yeah.
Someone, when I was majorly in my alcoholic existence, got me to draw the Cray twins, the twins and their brother. And at that time, there wasn't any imagery anywhere with the three brothers in the same picture. So I don't know, the person would still have that. I would.
Sorry about the dog, by the way.
I love Boaster.
Yeah, well, it's your fault for playing ball with him in the garden before, so he's with us. But anyway.
It's as much fun for me as he.
So people kind of, they'd catch you scribbling on a napkin or something, and go, oh, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah, that's pretty much how it is. And that's pretty much how I like it. And in some ways, that's my currency now. In that I'll do stuff and people will see it in a kind of throwaway kind of manner.
Right.
Rather than me putting it out there like what professional artists are meant
to do. Did it feel like... right, so you knew you could draw.
Mm.
But what was... Because I don't know if you have the same thing, but I've had lots of conversations with people about the I can't draw conversation.
Yeah.
And about, you know, can you pick up a pencil and make a mark on a paper, well, that's drawing. Mm. But what people mean is, don't they, I can make a recognisable picture of a house that looks the same as the house I'm looking at. That's what they're trying to do.
That's what people
was that
say.
Where your drawing was? Or was there? Did you have some sense of self-expression?
No, there wasn't. I didn't have any sense of expression in it at all. I would look at something and I would be able to mirror that with my hands and a pencil.
To sort of copy it.
Yeah.
Are you a lefty?
I am a lefty, yeah. My analogy on that is that if someone can butter a bit of toast, then they can draw. Or paint.
Yeah. That's very good.
That is as simple as it is for me. Yeah. And so the people who say I can't won't. It's not that they can't, they just won't.
Yes, and it's about a lot of loaded expectation about what drawing means.
Yeah, I mean, give a child a crayon, I mean, you know you're going to get a lot of mess, but you're also going to get what is within.
Yeah.
This is it. Have that. And
so what do you remember about that first life drawing class then? Was it nerve-wracking to go in, or were you just...
I'm always aware of new people and kind of wary, and that environment was full of 20-year-olds and you know, I really did feel in that time that I wasn't one of them anymore.
Bit old and frazzled.
Yeah, a bit of that. And there was a couple of people who were kind of mature, and so I thought that I would mix with them and see how the land lied, and they like going raving and they like doing all the other stuff that went on, and I found that I wasn't really, what's the word I'm looking for? It's on the tip of my tongue.
Well, I don't know. I'm thinking something like sort of compatible or something. I mean,
that's
especially
the
if
word.
You're
that's
a person sort of in recovery as well. I mean, it's just...
That's that first stage Alzheimer's that I'm...
Absolutely. Oh, tell me about it. Menopause, mate. Yeah. You've got an avocado.
I'm having that. I'm in that.
Yeah,
don't worry about
it. Fuck off. No, you're not. So you thought, but that wasn't there. But were the mature students, were they your people, or was nobody there your people?
No, they were. I actually got on famously with a few of the girls who were there.
Yeah.
And that I could draw on my experience and say to them, look, it's not worth getting all whoa about.
Oh, okay.
You know, so I was a kind of father figure to them, in a way, I suppose. It was a calming influence anyway.
Yeah.
And I found that even before my struggles, that I had that. There was something about my experience of the world that was a kind of calming influence to other people.
So quite big brothery, maybe, rather than...
Yeah, yeah. I've been described as that a lot.
Have you got brothers and sisters? I've
got three brothers.
Three brothers?
Yeah.
And where do you come in the...
I'm third in the chain.
Three out of four?
Yeah, three out of four. And strangely, my father's first marriage was... he had four girls. Oh. Went into the second one and had four boys. So there was a rumour, I don't know this for sure, but there was a rumour that when I was born, he really wanted me to be a girl. And so there was this thing about dressing me in pink. And my first memory is walking along a pavement with, you know, the reins they used to have to keep me back. I just remember being dressed in pink for some reason. I don't know whether that's
so you think there might be something in that?
Yeah, I think that my father... I don't know whether he was resentful. He probably was resentful to me that I wasn't a girl. But I don't know how realistic that is. But my experiences of him since have told me that there are reasons for what he did to me that, you know, that they need to be explained. You know, it's not rational.
Okay. So, do you know anything about your... So, were your parents together? Did you grow up with your mum and dad in the same house?
Yeah. We was all like... It was a family environment.
Yeah.
Very poor, poverty-stricken. He was a gambler and a drinker.
Right.
Didn't give her much money, and she struggled with everything and kept it all together.
And where was this, in London?
This was in Enfield, North London.
Yeah?
Yeah. And my mother, the most beautiful woman ever to walk the earth.
Oh.
Bless her heart. She died in 1987. And that's where my stop-start experience started.
So she wasn't that old when she died.
She was 57
then.
When she died, yeah.
What got her?
She had anemia for a long while. So she was falling over. She was very weak. She wouldn't go to the doctor, wouldn't take her iron tablets.
Right.
Varicose veins. I just remember her legs were just lumpy with varicose veins. And one morning they burst. She was in hospital for 2 weeks. On a life support machine for 2 weeks. She contracted an infection while she was in the hospital.
Poor love.
Had a heart attack. And...
Just couldn't cope with it.
I don't remember much about that experience.
How old were you then?
I was 18.
You were drinking quite hard by then, were you?
Well, I discovered drink at 15 at house parties.
Right.
And I kind of found a way of hiding behind the drink. So I would have something to drink... And I would fall asleep in a corner because I didn't feel like I fitted in.
Okay.
And so that was the start of my drinking experience.
Coping,
it was a getting away from
thing.
Stuff, you know. Being an observer, if you like. And so when that happened, there was more of that. I don't even want to experience this.
Yeah.
And there were things about that Saturday morning that happened. It happened at 6 a.m. And I woke up that day at 1 o'clock and was told, you know, and it was like, this is a major thing and I don't know... why it wasn't all like, let's get up and let's be urgent and, you know, so it's very foggy really.
Yeah.
But that happened on September the 5th and she died on September the 19th and was cremated on September the 29th. That period of September at that time, I can remember one day when I visited her at the hospital.
Yeah.
I can remember being in the car on the way to the crematorium. I remember nothing else.
Right.
So what my feelings
were.
So
it just bled out the whole...
Yeah, it was thing. Just black. Just
so you
black.
Were 18, so you're... How old is your youngest brother then?
So my youngest brother is... He was born in 1970, January 1970, his birthday coming up. And he'll be 44, so he would have been 16.
Right.
We're all very close. My eldest brother is now 49. Second eldest, 47. Me, 45.
Right, so it was every couple of years, babies, bang, bang, bang.
Yeah.
And so what was life like in the house then after? Were you living at home at that point?
But yeah, I was. I mean, I'd left school for a couple of years and I'd had a few jobs. And there was something about the moving into somewhere else that was all a little bit big and all a little bit grown up and all a little, I didn't feel like I knew.
Still a bloody baby.
Yeah, I know, but you see lots of people in here, lots of people who say, I couldn't wait to leave when I was 15, 16, let me get out there and do it. And there was this kind of sheltered wall, you know, that all seems a little bit, I don't know. I didn't know further than the park at the end of the road.
Yeah.
You know, if I went to Turnpike Lane, which was a 20-minute bus ride, it was like I was in a different country.
So you weren't out rocking and rolling in the West End and clubs and all that thing?
It was quite small. It was very, very,
world.
Very... Very small world I had, yeah, very close.
Do you think money had a lot to do with that?
Yeah.
Because there was no money to...
Massively, it's...
Just even what, get on the tube or anything?
Yeah, I mean, I've never been even aware of money management at that time especially.
Yeah.
And how money can help you explore different things in your world. And that's a bit of an issue now, really. But yeah, money's always been a bit of a bugbear of mine.
Yeah.
Mm. It seems like it's... all-consuming, and yeah, when they say money's the root of all evil, I do subscribe to that in some ways. You know, not everybody's got my decision-making process when it comes to finances. So, you know, that's not a standard thing for everybody.
Yeah.
There's lots of people I know who manage it perfectly well, and it's fine for them, and brilliant. But that's I try to steer as much clear away from money as I can.
So after your mum died, then what kind of happened? Did your I mean, because you said your dad was already drinking and gambling, so he wasn't maybe available to kind of keep the family together? Was there anybody else around?
It became clear very soon afterwards. It became very clear very soon after my mum died, when my father said, to all four boys, he said, right, you can all leave now, because I've wanted to be on my own for so long.
Oh, God.
He wasn't a nice man at all.
Right.
And, yeah, I never got any feeling of safety with him, you know, that warmth. So when my mum went, the backbone of the family went.
Right.
I've not seen my brothers, my two eldest brothers I've not seen since.
Yeah.
My father I've not seen since. Me and my younger brother had a bit more of a rapport, and as he grew older, he didn't need... I used to protect him from things and, you know, try and put myself in the way of stuff.
Yeah.
And he got to a point whereby he didn't really need that, and roles reversed. And he started helping me. He would... I remember when I split up with my first girlfriend, he put me up in his house.
Right.
And he got his sister-in-law to, put me up as well in Chingford. So, yeah, there was a role reversal thing, and I kind of felt unneeded, if you like, in that way. What am I in this? I don't know. And I was kind of stumbling from one disaster to the next. And he got married when he was 19, and he's now got his own business and kids. And
right.
It all seems to be that long, seamless story that I always yearned for, you know?
So, I'm recalling to myself that I'm... For myself, what I'm trying to do is find the thread through to the beautiful paintings that you make now. So life was kind of small, but I mean, there was love and comfort there when your mum was alive.
Yeah.
When you were little, was your dad quite sort of distant in the house then? When you were little, was he a raging?
He was just
temper?
Out all the time.
Right.
His temper was astonishing. What he would do.
Well, the drink will do that, won't it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the drink affects many people in many ways. With him, it was this violent temper. And it seemed to be an undiluted temper. Just this complete rage. And, you know, we wondered who was going to be next.
Right.
When he came.
Did his fists lash out then?
Yeah, more than his fists. He would pick things up and use tools.
And were you guys on the receiving end of that? Did your mum get that?
Yeah.
All of you?
As far as I was aware, my mum didn't get that.
Right.
All of us.
But he took it out on the boys.
Yeah.
What a bastard.
Mm. Not a nice man at all.
No.
I kind of exacted some kind of revenge when I was 16. I suddenly found some sort of realisation within this that what he was doing was wrong.
Yeah.
And I confronted him and said, look, this isn't going to happen anymore. Mm. And he spat in my face, which just underlined what he was. And then I saw that red rage, and he ended up in hospital. And that was just that moment I thought... there is something ugly about what I'm experiencing here.
Yeah.
And again, cut a long story short, I now try and avoid aggression in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
And I just won't have it in my world. And it's quite ironic that sometimes I feel that aggression but don't let it out, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's
a frustration more than anything else.
It sounds to me like you understand that the violence comes from anger.
Yeah.
But obviously anger is a perfectly natural human emotion, but it's very difficult to even acknowledge it, even go there.
Mm. Well,
if I get angry, then violence will happen.
Well, we were talking earlier about extremities, and that is one of the extremities that I deal with. I find I'm frustrated, not as much now. I'm in a world now in Southampton for the last 5 years whereby there's a warmth and an openness that I haven't experienced before. I consider Southampton to be kind of a spiritual home for me more than anything else.
Yeah.
You know, where I can...
The dog is now communing and is spiritualising with us. The whacking of the tail on the table is probably not a fantastic sound. Thank you both. It's beautiful. Do you want to come and sit up here with us? Come on. Come on. So,
there we go.
Had you got into trouble when you were a kid?
I was a good boy.
Yeah. And you went to school and...
I went to school. I learnt my stuff. My basic knowledge of maths and English was... I was top sets of everything. Yeah, top 1%. Even now I can... do long division and spell difficult words. And
yeah.
I was.
So you're actually a pretty bright kid.
Yeah, very intelligent.
Not really got any opportunity to flourish. What was school like?
It was always a place for me to find sanctity, if you like. Now, even though there was. When I tried to interact, I didn't wear the best clothes when I was little, and so I got a bit of bullying for that.
Yeah.
I remember one time when I was in the infants, I went to school with red trousers, bright red trousers, with a misshaped patchwork on my arse.
Right.
Which probably didn't go down well, you know,
what school kids are like. Fantastic.
Yeah, I could rock it now. So the education has changed. Here we are 40 years later, 35 years later. And for an intelligent child in this day and age, the opportunity they've got and the encouragement to flourish that they've got is a brilliant, brilliant thing.
Yeah.
I know many teachers, and you know they have that that sight. You know that you know.
Yes, well, they're obliged to notice and support. You know, that's your own special need, isn't it?
You know, the teachers. I mean, Enfield wasn't the most. Can I put it? It wasn't the best area.
Yeah.
And so the teachers there. I can just remember their way of teaching was by either throwing chalk at someone, or I remember a teacher we had called Mr. Quartley, who had two fingers on his right hand, and he used to knuckle you on the back,
on
the back of the head.
God, it sounds like you're in bloody Boston or something.
We used to call it the Quartley Crunch. It wasn't, you know, it was who's going to have that next? Yeah, it was just, yeah.
Could you just push that dog around there, please?
There you go, Boston. It's
just too much love.
Into something
too much
else.
Love.
So, yeah, I mean...
So you'd left school at 16.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, I wanted to go to college.
Right.
I didn't know what I wanted to do at college, but I wanted to go to college. And the maths teacher that I had, and considering maths was my best subject, the maths teacher called me a disruptive influence, and so my application was denied. It was... So I had to go and find a job.
So what was this disruptive influence?
Well, I don't know. I think I just questioned. I just spoke, and I, you know, if I don't understand something, I will ask. And I can't remember specifics of that time. And I just—it was the only teacher that I had.
Was everyone poor at school?
No, no. It was strange, really, because the rich kids were all the sporty kids. And I used to love football, and so I used to hang out with them, which was a really strange mix of everyone with all their nice clothes and where they're going to go and talking about what they're into.
And this club and that party and that whatever.
Then there's me with my same shirt every day and
you're crazy.
Holes in my trousers and all that, yeah. And I just, it was that, what linked me to them was the fact that I could play football as well as I could count and as well as I could do English.
Yeah.
And I just remember wanting just to be a footballer. All I wanted to do was be a footballer.
Yeah.
And I was really very good.
What's the team up there? I don't know.
The school I went to was Albany.
But what was the what team were you all supporting?
Well, I supported Spurs. It was a mixture of everything. Right. I supported Spurs just because, you know, you just pick a team. And I still love football to this day, but I love football. I don't love... one team. I don't like all the palaver that they have on like reality and magazines and all the rest of it that goes with it. But there is something about how someone can play football. There's a vision that only a footballer's got.
Yeah.
You know, and I appreciate that. You know, I do. Still do.
So, couldn't go to college.
You're still trying to find a thread of this art, aren't you? I don't think you'll find one.
I'm not sort of desperately looking for one. I'm just making the story. I'm just doing the chronology of it. So you didn't go to college, so you needed to get a job.
Yeah.
God, and you're like 17 or something. What were the options? What was possible?
At school in those days for me, when there was when you were in your fifth year, you were seen by a careers advice officer.
Oh, marvellous.
And I was waiting and waiting and waiting for my careers advice. Interview,
like
whatever,
thing.
Yeah. And I didn't get one. And everyone else was saying this, that, and that, and that, and I'm like, I don't, where's mine?
Yeah.
I'm looking around for it, and it never happened. And so I just didn't have a clue. Didn't have a clue.
So one day, you just didn't go to school anymore. And that
one day it all ended. You got thrown flour and eggs all over you.
Yeah.
People wrote things on your shirt.
But there were no adults looking at you going, paying attention to what was going to happen.
The football teacher that we had in that time, Terry Graves, his name was. He said, "You're going to carry on playing football." I said, "No, I haven't got a team."
Yeah.
He said, "What a waste!" And that was it. It's the only thing I can remember
that you can remember of a grown-up taking an interest. So, what did you do?
That summer I did nothing. I think that summer, and then I went out looking, and I don't know. I had no information to take me anywhere.
How do you this idea of getting a job? How do you get a job?
I don't even know how the connection between Enfield and Waltham Cross happened. That's a 4 mile difference, and I said earlier that my world was a little bit small.
Yeah.
I think my eldest brother, he went up there for some reason, for something, and so I went up there, and there was this new garden centre, home base, was being built. So I went in, and I said, "Is there any jobs?" And they said, "Yeah." And within a short space of time, I was one of your garden centre people. Help people with mixing serving paint and serving and all the rest of it. Green dungarees, you loved it.
Super cool. Super cool. I love a dungaree.
Green check shirt.
Yum yum.
It was a fudge colour tie.
Oh.
And big.
Oh, so a little bit. So you were looking a little bit sort of countrified.
And I had a mullet at the time as well.
Oh.
So yeah, I was.
I'm sure
was,
that wasn't fashionable even then, was
it? No, it never is. No,
it's never good unless you live in like Mississippi or something.
But see, it was really strange that all the women of a certain age there wanted to mother me. All of them. And there was a couple of women there, I think Pauline and Ruth Pitt, her name was, they kind of took me under their wing because one of them said to me, "You need to be taught and not tortured." And I don't know what they saw in me, you know?
Mm.
And that kind of knew that I needed pointing in the right direction. And I never really got to the bottom of that. And I don't know, it's almost like this, you know, I really want to know, but stay at arm's length kind of thing, you know? But I really wanted it. Come and get me. It's like Buster playing with his ball. Come and get me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was a good experience. I was there for 9 months.
Yeah.
And I can't think why I left.
But you were still a baby when you left.
Yeah, 19. And then 3 months unemployed. And I found another job in a picture framers around the corner in an industrial estate. And I was there for 3 months. But I had loads of jobs. I worked in a motor factors, which made brake pads for vehicles, a few months. And I suppose there was a bit of me that all the while I wanted to do was wait until I was 18 so that I could work in a betting office because I had this interest in horse racing. And I thought that might be where I could cultivate some kind of future.
Yeah.
And there was a job in an independent one in the main town of Enfield. And so they took me on and I learned that trade.
Because you knew about betting.
I knew about betting and I knew about horses and I had an interest and you know, I felt comfortable in that environment. Yeah. And I did. I managed to get myself into that industry. And I was with this independent for about 2 years. And then I thought, you know, there's the bigger chains, bookmakers.
Right, so I could be a manager or something. Yeah. You could.
So I applied to Ladbrokes and Coles and William Hill, and I got taken on by William Hill. That was in, 1990, that was, 1991. Yeah. And so I just went round. And this is where my sense of the world became a little bit more wider.
Yes.
In that I was a relief manager.
So you got moved around.
I went to, you know, as far away as Southgate and the wonders of Finsbury Park, and you know that I was around from place to place, and it was kind of I felt so comfortable in that environment. It felt like this is what my world was going to be.
Well, you've known it since you were a tiny kid.
Yeah, and you know, with that, there was this drinking culture. That, you know, it had always been there, and it felt like it was, you know, a parallel.
And it was men.
It was totally
male
patriarchal,
environment.
Yeah.
And what was I going to ask you? So this world is still quite small. I mean, you're talking about, you know, Finsbury Park. We're still up in North London, aren't we? It's still a tiny little patch.
Yeah.
So in your world, you must have known, you knew people, and people knew you.
Yeah.
I mean, were you a sort of, I mean, the guy who runs the betting shop, he's somebody, isn't he? I'm not saying you're a sort of local celebrity, you're a face, aren't you? Oh, Steve, yeah, I know him. He's a good guy.
Yeah, but I always used to keep myself off the radar.
Right.
You know, there was always this crowd of people who did things, and I was kind of always the onlooker. Right. And so I, you know, even with me and you meeting, I knew of you, I think, for about a year before we were actually introduced.
Yeah.
You know, even though I was part of the crowd through Sarah and Polly.
This word onlooker, it comes up a lot. You use it a lot.
Do I?
Yeah. You do. Oh, I didn't know if you used. I thought maybe you knew that. I thought maybe it was conscious then.
No.
Oh, there you go. I'll give you the little gift of information. Is it a dodgy world, the world of bookies and betting shops, or is it all very?
It's become more palatable now. When I was growing up,
it's quite heavily regulated now, isn't it?
Yeah.
But
it was a kind of mob rule when I was there. It was like there wasn't any. It was all word of mouth. There wasn't any disciplinary. There wasn't any. Forward planning or business directives.
Oh, okay.
It's just like people come in and give you money, and you give us the money, and we put it somewhere. And
there's a piles of fibres in a safe somewhere.
Yeah. So now it's all regimented. It's all heavily. But I don't know where this came from, but being kind of a clever person who found out other things rather than what I was told, I found ways of embezzling. As I grew older, and so if I was ever short of some money, then
there were ways of taking a little bit off the side here and a little bit.
Yeah. It was just like just changing a number legitimately, if you like.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not saying that that's a good thing. It isn't at all.
No, but it's
that kind of ended in my arrest in 1993 for fraud and.
Who'd noticed?
There was a guy who was a part-time police officer who I covered his shop one day, and this.
So
happened.
He was a part-time police officer, part-time better shop manager.
He was a full-time better shop manager, but part-time police officer.
Interesting combination.
I had no intention. It wasn't a part of my thinking to hide this from people. You know, it wasn't a case of, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm going to make sure he doesn't find out. I mean, it was there for everybody to see.
Do you think it was quite common practice?
Yeah.
Was everybody slipping a little bit here and a little bit there? And
absolutely.
You this give me a 50 and I'll actually give you changes if it's...
It's more complicated than that. I won't tell you how it's done, but...
Oh, go on, tell me privately later.
Yeah, go and get a job in Ladbrokes. But I don't think it's
so. He spotted it and decided
told my bosses, and my bosses turfed me out of the shop I was working in the next day and arrested me. And
was that like a?
It was like a bolt from the blue. Really, I never ever got into any trouble in my life. And then I suddenly thought, right, I know what am I going to do now?
What was the consequence of that?
I spoke to them. This is what the attitude was like in those days. I was arrested and taken to the police station, and they interviewed me. And as I was talking and told them what I was doing, the police officer was like gesturing sign language to me, as if it wasn't a problem, and you know, it's just not a problem.
Okay.
So they cautioned me.
Chill out. Fine. It's all gonna be fine.
Yeah. They just cautioned me.
Take your statement. Don't do it again, you naughty boy. Well.
So, you know, I got away with it, and I did. And I was then, after that, 3 years unemployed.
So it didn't actually have a negative impact on your... Because you didn't have to tell anybody, did you, that you'd had this police... Presumably everybody knew.
Well, wait, but that's...
Couldn't get work in the betting trade again.
No, that was all word of mouth, and my name would have been...
They'd have known. So, are you drinking at this point?
That's a loaded question, really, because I was never aware of the impact drink was having on
me. Right, it was just part of life.
It would be things like going into a pub on a Friday, having a lock-in, waking up at the pub on a Saturday, starting drinking again. And that would seem like a normal existence.
And you're young and your body can take it. And you're just rocking.
Yeah.
Yes. And if you kept a nice drink diary now, you'd be shocked at the units. Absolutely. But at the time, you're
absolutely
not.
Absolutely, yeah.
No, if I think of the amount of beer I would put away as a young woman, I mean, it's just ridiculous now. I don't know how I ever coped.
Me either.
But it never... It didn't get me, thank God.
Mm.
So you've been arrested. Out of work for 3 years, you said?
3 years.
What date are we now?
We're at 1993 now. So...
Okay, so I'm just thinking where we are in the world and the economy and all that sort of thing. Mm. So what were you doing? You were on the dole.
Yeah, I was on the dole. So there's other subplots that need to be talked about.
Give me your subplot.
1991 was my first venture into relationships with women. Okay, so I was working in a shop just near the Arsenal football stadium.
Yep.
And this woman walked in, and I thought, wow. And it was almost like that day we sort of got talking. We went for a drink that evening, and I kind of got the impression that there was a guy going on. As it turns out, these two were seeing each other, and she dumped him. And so we started seeing each other, and he was kind of stalking her. And after about 3 or 4 months, he hid in her wardrobe.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
And when she got in, he attacked her. And... lots of horrible stuff happened.
Oof.
He got arrested, blah, blah, blah. And so...
And you were her boyfriend at this
time? Yeah, I was nearly moved in with her.
I think
we were seeing each other and
all the rest of it. Yeah, you were a couple.
And then, 3 or 4 months after that, I found out that she'd started seeing him again. Yeah. And I was kind of devastated and didn't understand and... What is that about?
Yeah.
And so anyway, he worked for William Hill as well.
Okay.
So I had a friendship with him. Didn't know that he was this other guy.
Oh God! So it's all work and it's home, just like and it's the worst all soap opera that you can
imagine. And then so when I was unemployed that day, I remember walking into a pub in Finsbury Park and getting a drink, and out of the corner of my eye, I spotted him in the corner. This was after all that palaver. A couple of years later.
Yeah.
He'd obviously not found work and all the rest of it. And I thought, what do I do? I should have just walked away. But anyway, I didn't. I bought him a drink and we had a chat.
Yeah.
And we just tried to get round all of this that had happened.
Yeah.
We ended up being best friends for the next 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was in Turnpike Lane that became my home.
Yeah.
And basically, we were, like, joined at the hip. He was unemployed, I was unemployed. We'd just find ways of trying to get money.
Just getting by.
Yeah, and going into the pub and getting a drink and doing a couple of days' work for someone. And it was just a complete dead end, you know, which I felt that was the only thing I was...
That was my world. So basically, it was get up, go to the pub. The pub is where life is based.
Yeah.
Basically. And everything happens from you leave the pub, you come back to the pub. You leave the pub, you come back to the pub.
And so that the world of bollocksology became very much part of my existence.
What's that, sitting around just talking bollocks?
I don't know about that. You can talk about topical things like
news. And the world, and the news.
Yeah, and politics, and putting it all to rights.
And
you would have a really relevant opinion on these things, and it mattered, you know.
Yeah.
It says tongue in cheek. You know, but there would be this discourse that was interesting and that you only find in a pub. You know, and you get all walks of life in pubs. You get, obviously, you get doctors and you get all sorts down to your labourers, and everyone's got this. They're all mixing, you know, every now and again it all gets a bit volatile. But, you know, again, I chose to save myself in that scenario rather than getting involved in all the scrimmaging. And I saw some scrimmaging.
What do you mean, scrimmaging?
Well, like people getting thrown through the windows and fights and,
In the pub? In the pub. Oh, I see, right. So that was just all... That's going on over there.
That was just all part of it, yeah. And
were you here yesterday? So-and-so gave somebody a slap and...
Yeah.
But they're all mates again now.
There would be an apology going.
They were in hospital. Just let me get you a drink.
Yeah. And that again became an acceptable part of life.
Yeah. You
know? And I always kind of looked at the path that my life had taken, and I thought, Steve, this just isn't you, you know. You've always had this kind of healthy attitude towards life, and you've not been drawn towards trouble. And
I
suppose I used to reflect back and think that those things I had when I was young, that I would leave school, leave home, find a girlfriend and have a life and get a job, and it would all be smooth, and it never happened like that.
Yeah.
And so there was this constant looking somewhere else, but also feeling this is what it is, you know, trying to accept where I am now. I really found football when I was at this pub in Turnpike Lane.
Yeah.
I hadn't played football for about 8 years since school, and I remember the first game I had for this pub team didn't have a kit, right? So I had, someone had these tight lycra shorts, so I put them on. Someone else had these big long woolly tights above my knees, right? And I borrowed someone's boots and I put the yellow top on that this pub had, and I ran on to the pitch. And within three strides, my legs couldn't take it.
I'm not 16 anymore.
So that was just a funny moment. And then I played football with them for 8 years. And I would smoke I can't even put an amount on my hours. Silly amounts. And yet I would run up and down the pitch all the time. And as I got fitter and I became captain of that football team. And, you know, within that environment, I had a bit of respect and a bit of savvy.
I wasn't
one of the people who got drunk and went mental.
And a slob.
I would sit there, trying not to fall off the stool.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would go fight pint for pint with people who worked hard and weighed 20 stone and could drink, like, you know, all sorts. Just pint after pint after pint. This is like from 5 in the afternoon till 3-4 o'clock in the morning. Non-stop.
And funding it all?
It was through...
Were you running a massive slate?
Kind of. There was a bit of that. You know, I would give my labouring services. Most of them were builders.
Right.
So I would have a day and all the rest of it, and it would be like, all right for that, all right for that. And it was this juggle of non-existent money.
Were you betting?
I was a...
Quite an efficient
better. One of my things I had to come away from during rehab was my gambling. It became an issue.
Right.
Purely because I had no concept of end. I could gamble limitlessly, and I would put that as a priority in front of food and in front of rent, and at the time I had a mortgage and in Walthamstow. This was a bit after that.
Yeah.
And that went sour because of my lack of financial management, and gambling was a part of that, and drink was a part of that, and other things were parts of that.
So a sort of was it that blinkers tunnel vision thing? Nothing else exists but the next bear, the next bear, the next bear. Or was it more of a sort of lifestyle thing? This is just where we are, there's chat, there's drink, there's a fag.
Well,
and time just goes by.
So that within those 3 years, it was a different time for a different thing. So you couldn't have a bet at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Right.
So I would have a drink.
Oh, okay.
And then the afternoon happened,
you'd have
a bet. You couldn't have a bet in the evening, so you'd have a drink. And I went.
So it's just one continuous cycle of...
It was continuous, trying to... I don't know whether I was trying to block the reality of everything out, you know, or feelings that I had. Because I was kind of always aware that I'd not grieved for my mother, you know, and that was kind of... It cropped up every now and again, you know, and I had these... massive feelings of loss, and when I went home, there was this blackness that I just can't really explain to people. It was just like a hole that I was in, and at that time when I was on my own, I just wanted to be swallowed up. That life did not matter to me, really.
So staying in the circle of the pub's open, so I'm in the pub, the boogies, it just keeps you going. I don't have to acknowledge.
This is my pattern. That is my pattern. That's what I do. This is how it is. And I suppose all yearning for something better as well. And something better came along when this guy who I'd befriended, who went out with my first girlfriend, all the rest of it, his brothers were employed by London Underground, and they said they're recruiting. And I kind of scoffed and laughed a little bit, and, you know. Anyway, they said, what have you got to lose? Apply. Yeah. So I applied. They got me forward for a test and an interview, and for me, the tests were really simple. But 40 people were at this interview doing the same test, and only two of us got through.
Yeah.
And so I had an interview after that, and I told them I'd not been employed for a while, but I'd done some odd jobs with self-employed builders. Yeah. And by this time, I used to do pub advertising. The pub that I was in, they got the chalk pens.
Oh, and do the signs and stuff, yeah.
And doing that. So I was going around a few pubs in North London doing those signs. And so I'd become employable in some way. And so I managed to get a job at the Underground. They took me forward for the training centres and 6 weeks training for the Underground. And then I was back in employment and earning.
So suddenly you're a grown up employed person?
I felt like I'm a legitimate person again, yeah.
Did you miss the pub life?
Well, the social life of it all, you were happy to be engaged and employed. Yeah, but I mean, I was still playing for the football team, you know.
Yeah,
it wasn't
right.
just that. I played for the football team on a Sunday. I was still drinking very heavily.
So life didn't change that? You just have money in your pocket, really?
I just had to make room for this job.
And is it, what was it, a 9-to-5 world, or is it a shift thing?
Oh, shift, yeah, shift, so lates would be 4 o'clock until 1 in the morning.
Right.
Earlies would be 5 o'clock until 2 in the afternoon. My sleep's
always... quite a nice sort of camaraderie there, I'd imagine. Is it quite a teamly feeling?
It is a very teamly feeling. But, yeah, me and my questioning soon became apparent because I thought I could do it all better.
Oh, OK.
Right,
so why do we do it? Because that's a bit shit, isn't it? And people going, excuse me? I've been doing this for 25 years.
I know. Yeah, but
young fellow,
even so, I still had that kind of rapport. And there's always been that bit of me that has rapport with people, you know? Even though I try and steer clear, I can talk to people. I hope I don't come across as a goon. Maybe with women I come across as a goon quite a lot, but who doesn't, really? So that was a new start, if you like. Became clear to me that the people who had the life in the pub, I wasn't part of that anymore.
Right.
And over a period of time, it kind of subsided, and I managed to buy a flat in Wolverhampton. I don't even know how that happened. My credit rating was like minus God knows how many.
There were people very keen to, well, still less now, but they were very keen to flog mortgages
in those days.
Extremely keen.
They were. So I found a flat, and it was, I bought a flat in 1996 for £40,000. That doesn't seem heard of, does it? Everything else was about £50,000 at the time, and this one skanky place in Walthamstow was going for £40,000. And this mortgage mob in Chester were prepared to lend me some money.
So are you still a single man at this point?
I'd had another relationship in 1993 with someone who lived in Albert Square. As if it doesn't get more surreal. So I was seeing her for a while, and she became pregnant, and then she thought, do you know what, I want a bit of greenery. Colin will laugh at that word I just said. Anyway, she moved to Grays, and it was all a bit problematic.
Grays is Essex, isn't it?
Grays is Essex,
out of it,
And things were a little bit on off with us, and it was like, She became pregnant. I was like, I don't even know if I'm ready for that.
Yeah.
And then she said, well, Steve, you're the father. You know, you need to man up, if you like. So I did. I manned up, moved to Grays with her. And then the baby was born, and it came out brown.
Oh, Stevie.
That's an OMG moment. I don't like saying that. I don't ever text OMG.
No.
But there's a few OMG moments.
Yeah, that kind of...
And that was like, that just sent me spiralling into somewhere that I hadn't even... No, no.
Wow. That's a kind of bit of a cartoonish kind of story, isn't it?
Yeah,
but I mean, perhaps that would have hurt very deeply.
Burnt my soul. But see, there's something, you've just said the two things in the one, that are kind of a story of my life, in that there are experiences that I've had that have hurt really, really deeply, but humour is the salvation.
Yeah.
And there has to be slapstick. Someone said to me recently, three or four years ago now, that if you just take one or two steps back from your world, it's all a comedy farce. And it is. It really is. I try now, this is one of my resolutions that I've had from the new year has been to decide not to worry, because the world will go on.
Just,
you know,
to choose. It
will, yeah.
Yeah. Just to choose it.
It just go along with that wave. I'm on a bit of a wave at the moment because of the art. You know, I'm now an artist and making my work, and you know, I'm not promoting myself as I should be doing. But the things will happen despite myself.
Yeah,
that's what I found. That something things happen.
Well, one of my dad's great phrases: "Something will happen."
Mm.
The sun will come up. Mm. The sun will go down again. Mm. The chance, you know, there is no chance that nothing, something will happen.
Absolutely. I've just found that when I have influence on what something will happen, it always seems to end in turmoil and torment. So I try not to engage with that process anymore.
It's a brilliant, and please, I'm not suggesting in any way that the approach you're taking is not working brilliantly for you at the moment. So that's wonderful. But I wonder how that fits with the idea of avoiding the sadness of your mother dying and the negative impact that has had. I suppose there's a difference, isn't there? Sorry, I'm answering my own question.
No,
between
sure.
Avoidance and... It's not that you're avoiding the feelings, you're choosing not to engage with them in a particular negative way, I suppose.
Well, that is definitely my bottom line. You know, how relevant it is now to how it will impact on me, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's definitely had my home life when I was a child has definitely had a bearing on how I choose my relationships, how I act in company, and the path my world has taken, you know, along the way. And most of it has been like something's gone wrong, so I move on to the next thing. It's like this stop-start thing.
And I recognise that so much. I can sort of compartmentalise sections of my life where the way I sort of describe it is I start something, I make it amazing and fabulous and brilliant and shiny, then I get to a point where I can't cope for some reason. Mm. That all comes crashing down around my ears, but I'd never go back to it. What happens is I sweep it all away and start again. Mm. And over the course of my life, that's happened with friendships and places I've lived and things. I just go, right, that obviously all fucked up. Right, pretend none of that ever happened.
Let's forget that one. Yeah.
Move on to the next thing, which is a fabulous way of coping and has enabled me to reinvent myself and move on. Mm. But you don't have to lose a lot.
Absolutely.
You know, a lot of all the good stuff goes as well.
Well, I think more than that, I think for each different period, not only do you lose it, but you lose a little bit more. The next thing happens and then you lose a little bit more. And then when it finally hit the fan for me in my flat in Walthamstow in the year 2004, when it finally hit the fan, not only had I lost my flat and...
Because you weren't giving up the mortgage because you were gambling money away and drinking money
daughter,
away.
My daughter, which we'll probably talk about in a minute.
Right.
But I lost that.
And yes, because there is a beautiful baby.
I'd lost my,
which is yours.
My work. I'd now gone down to this place that felt like below rock bottom.
Yeah.
You know? And there was something about it that, like, in some ways was comfortable. You know, there
did
was
it
this...
feel like it happened very fast?
No.
Or could you see? Were you aware at the time? That's hard to say, isn't it?
It's very difficult because when I was in that, I was no stranger to things not being good.
Yeah.
And so that was just a progression of that.
Yeah.
And yet my real conscious life that I wanted to make and progress and be in the world, it just kept restarting. But this progression of badness.
The foundation underneath was just rotting and rotting.
Yeah, it was like building a brick wall with jelly.
Right.
It wasn't good at all. 2004, I'd been told in January 2004 that I was an alcoholic.
By who?
By a drug and alcohol advisor.
Oh. Mm. How did you get that?
I'd been having long-term therapy for things with a person at the London Underground. And I rang up the department one day. And I said to them, my antidepressants aren't working because I'm drinking. That was the only statement I made. I didn't say how much I was drinking.
Right.
Nothing. They said, let me pass you on to our drugs and alcohol team. This guy rang me up and he kind of listened to me. He said, you need to come in for a chat. I went in for a chat and he quickly found out that I was using food, I was using people, I was using prescription drugs, I was using gambling, I was using drink, I was using anything I could possibly get my hands and self onto as something, as a crutch, as as a way of coping, as a way of surviving.
And so, it was just all revealed in that moment. Yeah. And was that a surprise to you?
Yeah, I said, not a chance. Not a hope. Really? Don't talk stupid. Right, so I went to this this group therapy thing, right? And this is where this guy said to me, so I tried to walk out the door, and he said, Steve, he said, you're so welcome to walk out the door. He said, but you'll never cope with the problems in your mind if you have another drink. That statement made me think, well, I've got problems in my mind, not about the drink.
Okay.
I stayed because of the problems
communicating
and being.
Yeah.
So I stayed. And I said to him, I'm not an alcoholic. I can stop drinking any time you want. So I stopped drinking.
Yeah.
I didn't have a drink for 50 days and it was easy. It was really easy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then on the 50th day, I thought I'd celebrate. So I went to the shop, 2 bottles of vodka. 2 hours later, I'm hanging by my vacuum cleaner cable off of my banister in my house in Warmster.
There you go.
And the slapstick of this, the humour of this, is that the vacuum cleaner cable broke and I nearly broke my back.
Thank fuck God.
So that was that experience. And it just opened my eyes to, like, that was that. I've celebrated that, which was really a little bit stupid.
Yeah, celebrating. That was a kind of interesting way of celebrating.
Yeah, yeah. And all of that turmoil came back to me. Yeah. I hadn't had a drink and it was kind of, I could think my way through this. All of a sudden I was back there.
Yeah.
And I thought, all right, this is going to be difficult, man. So I was basically medically retired from the underground. Right. Such a benign company. They looked after me in more ways than I deserve, seriously. They paid for my rehab. They came to visit me. This guy came to visit me in Weston-super-Mare. And I was introduced to this world of 12 steps to recovery.
Yeah.
Which I thought my way through into thinking that can be done better, let me tell you.
Just before you go on from that, I just wanted to challenge something you said, more than I deserved. I completely rubbish that thought. I think that the treatment you had from London Underground is the human way that we would hope that organisations that we give ourselves to would look after us. I think if you're saying that London Underground looked after you, well, so they bloody well should.
Yeah.
And just because other companies don't do it, I think that says more about the other companies. It's not that you deserve it. I think that's worth just sort of challenging.
Thanks for pointing that out. I do have this self-defeating kind.
It's a little bit of an easy shorthand, and I know I do it myself, but those words... they hurt us.
Yeah, I know there'll be a couple of people who listen to that and listen to that and they'll say, Steve, you do that again. You don't need to do that, you know?
I do it myself. I do it myself. Like when I say, and I build things up and they're all glamorous and fabulous and wonderful. And you get, well, okay, own that a bit.
I've been encouraged to embrace things about myself, you know. And there was something, I was speaking to Colin Callister a few weeks ago.
My first interviewee.
A beautiful thing that was. He often gives me gems of advice.
Does he now?
Yeah, he does. He's a good boy.
I've
now lost my train.
About self-defeating. Don't say things against yourself.
I am talking about that. I just need to click back into that train of thought and I'll get there. But it's going to take a while.
Weston-super-Mare was, it was something that London Underground just said, we've got this
They have communications with different places around the country.
Yeah.
So there's a place in Plymouth, there's a place in Weston-super-Mare and Somerset. I think they've got a place in Yorkshire as well, but they can access these rehabilitation places. So there's a lot of people from the underground who had problems at that.
Well, do you know, I was just thinking that the idea that this organisation has got these connections suggests that at some point in their history they've gone, Jesus, we've got a bit of a problem here. Mm. We've got a whole lot of people who are falling apart. We
so my counsellor at the rehabilitation, he said to me that I really would like to make you a life's work. I've never known someone to have six live addictions going on at the same time.
I said to him,
you need to go to London. There's one in every street. You know, there's people relate. All sorts of people, even though they haven't got problems, relate to the problems of an addict. They're just a bit more exaggerated, a bit more extreme, you know? And the thing about an addict or someone who struggles with alcoholism is that they don't think their way through things. They, you know, there needs to be a lot of discussion and, you know, it's not just called normal people. I hate that phrase.
Yeah,
but it's people
shorthand.
Who actually...
Yeah.
Don't have those exacerbated problems. They have the way of coping. You know, if they get a financial problem, they cope with that. If they have an emotional problem, they cope with that. And my experience is that people who struggle with those addictive, obsessive personalities haven't got that way of switching off the bad and looking at what do I do. You know?
Yes, they instantly go to panic.
And and that's destructive.
Cope.
That's the
it destructive feels uncomfortable, thing. It's scary, so I must make that, but I must slap that down.
Mm. I remember what Colin said.
Oh yeah, go on.
Yeah, he turned around and said to me, I said to him one day, Colin, yours is so great, and he said, I know. I want to get you to get to a point where you say, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm in a place whereby, you know, I need to embrace what my talents are. It's, I don't know, it's not an easy process, really, you know, with all the problems with responsibility and I feel pressured and overwhelmed quite a bit, you know, going out to pubs and everyone I know's in a band or gigging and they go to, like, pubs and places like that to play and, you know, it's difficult. I sometimes don't feel that connection with the whole environment, you know.
How is it being around alcohol as part of that?
As long as I've got a good reason to be somewhere, I've not got any problem. That's... I just choose not to associate myself with it in all ways. So I won't have a wine gum because wine's in the world. I won't have a steak and ale pie. You know, so I disassociate myself. I go to a pub and I no problem in getting a Coke or a soda water and lime or an orange juice, or sometimes I'll go mental and have a bit of a non-alcoholic cocktail.
Crazy.
Let me tell you. And Schlur is a good way forward.
Yes, yum yum. Mm. I like all the elderflower things that are around now.
Yeah.
Mm. They don't, sometimes lots of them. Also, when I was, I didn't drink for a long time because I used to have kidney problems.
Okay.
And I'd get all achy and horrible and I just went off it. And I used to find I was constantly freezing cold in the pub. Because sometimes you're drinking like these fizzy drinks with ice in them.
Yeah.
Whereas beer
is
very sort of warm beer, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'd be bloody freezing. And that was my sort of great association. Anyway, that's me. So, so you had your big moment. So you had a list of, what was it, six live addictions?
Yeah.
What was on that list?
So you got
drugs
alcohol.
Alcohol there.
Prescription drugs,
hey. So what's this? We're buying... Naughty painkillers,
Nurofen. Paracet. I would have a packet of Nurofen because I thought if I had them, I won't get ill.
Oh, okay.
That was my thinking.
Okay.
It's completely illogical, really.
So lovely and numb.
Yeah.
Lovely and chill it down. Put the pills in.
And I was also on antidepressants and sleeping tablets.
Yeah, so you're just slapping them.
Yeah, just...
Just go, I'll have four of those.
That was my timetable, was when I'd come home from my shift at the London Underground. And I deserved to pamper myself, so I would just get high. Was that?
Christ, I'm terrified. Okay, so we've got those two. Those are the acknowledged ones in the world.
Food. Gambling.
Oh, yes, gambling, that one. That one's identifiably naughty, isn't it? Yes, food. What's this one?
Women!
Tell me about that. This is something I don't know about.
It's kind of...
Just one night stand?
Well, that was a very small part of it, but, you know, there's... A thing about sex addiction, which, in the same way that alcoholism is very far removed from alcohol, sex addiction is really far removed from sex in my world.
I get that.
I mean, I didn't have a computer in those days, so it was the online chat bars.
Yeah.
I remember one night I got chatting to this girl, it was just a voice, and I thought, and we've got a rapport going. So this was like 3 o'clock at night, I was in Walthamstow, I got a cab from Walthamstow to Gravesend. got out of a cab.
In Kent, everybody?
In Kent. Well, yes. Done.
That's a long way.
It's a long way. So I said to the cab driver, just hang on for 10 minutes. Went to the door, she opened the door, I've gone, oh no, and went back in the cab.
Right.
And it was that yearning for some connection that felt valid, and it mortifies me that my behaviour, at the time it didn't feel like bad behaviour, but there was a lot of things about the way these things had manoeuvred me and how I managed myself in the world. You know, and I look
A rash spending of money.
That cost me about 160.
Going out in the middle of the night to somewhere where, you know, you're putting yourself at huge risk of God knows what. And that's all very kind of out of control kind of behaviour, isn't it?
Yeah, and that was my reality. It was talking to voices on the end of a phone was my reality. I'm all of a sudden aware that we're on a podcast and I'm showing the world. But anyway, in for a penny, in for a pound. So I used to ring up escorts a lot.
Yeah.
Right? And so you get an escort and you know, do your business and all the rest of it. I would have an escort around to talk to them.
Yeah.
You know, and have them say to me that it's okay.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
There's something about this
physical intimacy that was like, it's a big deal.
And yet you weren't a loner in your day-to-day life. I mean, you've got this community of friends at the pub and other people you work with, and you say you talk to people very easily, but at the end of the day, that one-on-one connection, where's that?
Well, there's that. That's the kind of earth that feeds the plant, you know? Yeah. And metaphorically, my earth is minimal, if you like.
And food, tell me a bit about food as well.
It's like a bulimic style eating. Yeah. In some ways I still have.
Yeah.
I could buy a box of cornflakes and eat it in one sitting.
Yeah.
And then I would go a few days and not. It's very erratic.
Yeah.
I don't have a plan, a food plan, a food diary.
Yeah.
I would virtually eat anything.
Yeah, so no concept of preparing a meal, sitting a meal, eating it, just
doesn't matter.
What's around, shove it in. What's on the shelf, shove it in.
As much as I can fit in.
Yeah.
And a counsellor at rehab said that I ate out of anger. She gave me an apple one day.
Yeah.
And so I ate into this apple. And apparently this rage that we were talking about earlier was on my face when I crunched into this apple. It was like...
Yeah.
You know? And she said, what's that about?
Like smashed.
It's like, sucking the life out. She said I used to eat an apple out of anger with my dad.
So when you were in rehab in Walthamstow, you lived in this place? Did you visit it?
No, I was an inpatient.
An inpatient, that was the word.
And so my flat in Walthamstow, it had become a kind of... That's another story as well. When I first moved into my flat in Walthamstow, I had a survey that was just like, open the door and it's not falling down.
Yeah.
Very cheap. Within a couple of months.
Of course it was completely void.
Woodwork. Everywhere. Woodwork everywhere. So instead of doing one room at a time, which is a proper person's way forward, I ripped out all the wood in my flat.
Okay.
Every last little bit of it.
So you were living in a weird building site.
Yeah,
yes.
Basically. And there was a drip from my bathroom.
Yeah.
It was like a cave I was living in. And I'd become sick on the underground. I didn't go in a lot. I got a visit from a boss one day, and he came in to this house, for want of a better word, and he was just gobsmacked. He couldn't believe what he was seeing. The only light switch that was working, we were standing under to talk, and while we were talking, it exploded and fell in between us. And he was like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
I just didn't know anyone could live like this.
Yeah.
And anyway, I bit by bit got things fixed, but the drip carried on, and I got people in, so many people, to try and stop this drip. Downstairs, she had a dog very similar to yours, very big and bouncy. The ceiling would just bow in her bathroom all the time, and every now and again you'd hear a crash, and I'd have to get someone to fix hers and try to fix mine, and it was ongoing. It was like, I cannot fix this drip, I cannot stop her ceiling from falling in.
And this is like a horrible sort of metaphor, isn't it?
So it is, it's kind of, there's never just myself that's impacted, there's, you know, and I'm quite aware of how things, little things, anyone, not just me, little things you do and little things you say and how much impact could be had on someone else you know. And that kind of makes me want to be a bit second thoughtish about my choices that I make. I don't just dive into what I think is right these days. I'll try and run it past my lovely friends that I've got.
Rehab, when you were an inpatient.
Rehab.
How long were you there?
I was there for 9 months. I was detoxed for 2 months. They gave me more pills to detox than I was taking anyway.
Yeah.
And that to bring it down. And the last 3 months I was actually drug and drink free. The only 3 times that I can really remember. And it was just a wonderful, wonderful time of my life.
Yeah.
That it was quite scary at the end when I had to leave, you know, going back into the world.
Yeah.
But that whole 9 months had introduced me to what my future was going to be, you know. And at the time I thought it would be meetings and giving myself, you know. It was all about giving myself, and what you give, you receive.
Absolutely. The idea of service, which is in 12-step, which is
ways that you don't really realise, you know. It's a good thing to say, well, I want this, this and this in return for that, but it's a good thing for me not to be choosy about how I receive what I receive.
Yeah.
You know, what happens, happens. Yeah. And I do believe that. I mean, I quickly became irritated by the meetings and the 12-step of recovery, because there's this thing about God that is all-consuming within that. And whilst I understand about faith and people have that and it saves so many people, I had my kind of own take around that sort of stuff, and it didn't work for me. It really didn't work for me. But there are elements of the 12-step that there's a book that they give out in their recovery, and there's some bits in that that are cemented in my thoughts.
Yeah.
The one about it's a passage in the big book called The Promises, which is a brilliant, brilliant read.
Yeah.
That feeling of uselessness and self pity will leave us, you know. Contempt before investigation. All of that.
Did you do making amends and all that?
Well, yeah, I had a sponsor, which was quite difficult because I never turned up to when we would meet on time.
Well, sponsors are supposed to be quite tolerant of that sort of thing, aren't they?
Yeah.
Amends, do you just want to explain what amends is? Because people who don't know about 12-step might not know.
Mm, well, the amends are the people that you have wronged in your past in some way, where possible. Amends need to be made, and some people's idea of amends is just an apology, but I think
it's more of a
physical action. So it's your whole self that's involved in this,
right.
In this making amends.
This act of...
And if you expect the amend to be made as a result of that, then you've got it wrong.
Yeah.
What you do is you just give and you leave it. You put it to one side, and there are some times that. You can actually think you're making amends by getting in touch with someone, but where that can create a worse deal for them.
Yes.
So, you know, the amend that you make, for me, the amend that I make is by staying away from those people and just trying to be as good a person as I can be. This takes me bang into my daughter in that situation.
Yeah.
And I've not seen my daughter for 8 years.
Yeah. It was her birthday recently, wasn't it?
It was last Wednesday. Yeah. She was 15. Yeah. I always put a little Facebook message.
Yeah, I know, I noticed.
To hope that she sees that. And I kind of have the attitude that if I treat everyone like I treat my daughter, and she was by far and away the most profound experience when she was born.
Mm.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't even think it was possible that sort of thing could happen.
And, were you there?
Yeah, I was there. Yeah. I was... Me and her mum, we did... This was really horrible, but I've shared so many things, I might as well share this.
Come on, get it out.
So me and Sharon were seeing each other, and after about a month, she fell pregnant.
Right.
We didn't even know each other. It was all a little bit weird. And it was like... This is this was in 98, and after the 1994 Grey's experience of that pregnancy, I thought, oh my goodness... So I'd already had the final straw when it comes to women.
Yeah.
And this had happened. And I thought, why am I going to get wrong? Oh, I don't know. Anyway, the 9 months was spent with me kind of fighting to be part of that relationship. I think she just expected me to leave.
Right.
And I didn't. I really wanted to be something relevant and
something,
whatever that something was. And the day she was born, she was 2 weeks late, and they had to induce Sharon, and she was in a lot of pain, and I was laughing. And I was like laughing at her being in pain after the way she treated
me. It can be a fair reaction. Let's think kindly of you, so you weren't being a bastard. You were just terrified, so you laughed. I mean, seriously, people do get a bit hysterical when they're terrified.
No,
that wasn't a very helpful thing to do.
No.
I've had two children, and I'd have poked you in the eye if you'd done that. So, anyway.
Yeah. So, 10 to 10, June 15th, 1999, little Morgan popped out, and she was...
Little Morgan!
She was glowing orange, and it was singing like an opera singer. That wasn't a cry. And I was the first person to hold her.
Oh,
and she was there, and it was like, oh my goodness. Man. And at that time, and during the course of the next 7 years, Morgan was the one relationship I had in my life that hadn't gone wrong. And it was the
so you and Sharon
beautiful thing
managed to make
we
a
we didn't no she was
a friendship even or a
no she was seeing someone else while she was pregnant,
right?
So she moved him in when Morgan was very young, for 5 or 6 months old, I think. Which was difficult. I mean, I didn't have any love for Sharon, but I didn't know where my place in that was.
Yeah.
And Sharon would never let me have Morgan on my own in my flat. I mean, I'm not going to say that I didn't have any agency in this, because I was drinking. Things were very, very difficult for me. She probably saw that. She probably noticed that. And I have to acknowledge, I didn't acknowledge it at the time, that it was all her fault.
Yeah.
That's what it was. And so now I can't think like that. You know, I had as much agency in that, even if it wasn't, I wasn't saying how I was feeling.
Yeah,
that was my agency within that.
Yeah.
And things were all very traumatic. And after 7 years of, I would take Morgan to nursery and school and bring her back to her house.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed my own time in my own house with Morgan.
Yeah.
After 7 years, I saw things within the setup there when I was there that were really, really hostile. And that hostility, I didn't want to grow up with that. I remember thinking a lot of times when I was younger, why is my family together when it's just like this all the time?
Okay.
And so I made a decision to, for the hopefully the benefit of Morgan, that she didn't grow up in that hostility. So I left that situation. She was in a family that loved her. She was in a family that didn't have that hostility when I wasn't there.
Were there any other kids by this time?
She had another child, Danielle, who was 4 when Morgan was born. And I have to keep falling back to that. Reason that I made that decision was that it would be better for her in the bigger picture, because if I'd have stayed, someone would have got hurt, whether it be me or her. She had 7 brothers, and that, you know, it was all very hostile and volatile and angry. And
Sharon had 7 brothers.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Who all think you're the biggest shit on the planet.
Yeah.
So at that time, when Morgan was 7, and that was the time that you kind of moved away from that setup. Where were you in?
I was in Bournemouth
recovery rehab. So you were in Bournemouth by then.
Yeah, I left Weston-super-Mare September 2004. Chose to go to Bournemouth, and I was in Bournemouth and doing this. Don't know really know what to do with my stuff, but with my world, but I need to do something. And so the Bournemouth and Paul Foundation.
The life drawing class.
Yeah,
happened.
Well, there was only life drawing.
We got there.
There was life drawing once a week.
Yeah.
And For me, that was just drawing. There's drawing that I see now, even now, that kind of beats me, and I find it fascinating. That this kind of drawing isn't of something, and I wonder what it is that's made those mark in terms of what they're thinking and what they're experiencing.
Yeah.
And it really fascinates me. And from that, I went to my university application was accepted in that same year to Southampton. And in this whole learning process that I was able to do now and not able to do when I was younger, I have learned in all manner of art forms that it all kind of starts with a line. No matter what you do, even if you make a line with your arm and you're a performance artist, if you work with a camera, you'll point the camera at something. It won't just be, well, it could be a green wall.
Yeah.
Fair enough. But it all starts with something, with a line, with a movement. And I think I need to... intellectualise things sometimes because of the information that I've taken in and my want to sound like I know what I'm talking about.
But it's sort of like you kind of go past it, and then you have to, and then you kind of come back at it.
You need to.
You go, oh, I went too far. Too much thinking.
It's like a filtering. Yeah. It's given and fed and opened up to all this information, and you know it's just taking in what I find relevant to my life.
There's somebody I still don't know. I've always meant to go back and look at, find out who it is. There's a concept which I think I read about in terms of business ideas. I can't remember because I did an MBA a few years ago, which is that there is a simplicity which is on the other side of complexity.
Okay.
So you start off with a very simple idea and you think, yeah, but it's much more difficult than that. It's much more complicated than that. It's not just as black and white as that. And then you go through, the example I always come back with is all you need is love, which is an incredibly simple idea. But when you first say it, it's like, well, that's just bollocks, that's just pie in the sky. Mm. And then you go through all the blah, and then you go, oh, yeah, that's it. Mm. That's all there is. Mm. You know, and it's so there is a... You almost have to go too far through the expansion of it all to get it right back down to condense
there's
it
to two things thing. that makes me think of, right? The first thing is a guy called Martin Creed.
Martin Creed!
Thing that he did one day. He said, I'm going to find out what the most interesting thing you can do with a piece of paper is.
Right.
So he was drawing on it and he was folding it and he would write things on it.
Yeah.
It just wasn't doing it. So I don't know how long this process took him. I would imagine it was a few months.
Yeah.
Being a professional artist, you do try and explore all sorts of things.
Yeah.
He's ended up screwing it up, giving it up, putting it on the table and making a piece of art out of a screwed up piece of paper, which is that in itself has come to this really simple thing by going to the end.
A million miles through the thing.
And the second one is a book by Paulo Coelho called The Alchemist, which is the story of a little peasant boy who wants the world. He wants to go and explore and he wants to find himself. And he goes and he does and he goes to all different places. I won't tell you the ending.
Right.
Brilliant book.
Okay.
And I don't read, but I read that.
That's on my my Smooth Style No Bits podcast reading list Should make one on the website.
And so there is that element of, you know, you have to go and see the things that are irrelevant to find the things that are relevant.
Oh, completely. Completely. You know. Oh, yeah, don't get me started on that. We'll just be, you should preach into the converted there.
Yeah.
People, well, yeah, of course you're going to think that 99% of the art in an art gallery is crap, but one of them is going to move you in a way that you've never been moved before by anything apart from the birth of your child or the death of your mother. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all right, there's a lot of bollocks, but is it?
Both of which are memories that are instilled in any work that I make, I would guess. I think that's all a bit of a under the surface process. You know, there's probably stuff that's subconscious, you know, even though I'm painting something of now. There's always
Do you see yourself as... Because there is, you know, it could be a story that says there was this one Steve and now there's this other Steve. Do you see it like that? Or is it all the same... Is it a continuous line or was it a real rebirth?
A real rebirth.
What was that? Rehab or art school did that?
Art school did that. So, especially Southampton, came to Southampton, And university, if someone had said to me 10 years ago that I'll be going to university, my goodness. And the pivotal point, I think, of that process, I suppose there's two things really, but the one main important thing was getting to know Sarah Filmer.
Right.
Who has just got this beautiful warmth about her, and is this inclusion of people in things. She's very
Sarah's an artist as well, we should
say. She is, she's a filmmaker.
Because I haven't had her on the podcast, although she's been invited a million times. Mm. You describe her as a filmmaker, right. Okay. Is that what she calls herself?
No, probably not.
No. Yeah, artist.
But I think she has an eye for film.
Yeah.
That probably she doesn't realise as well. I think that needs exploring.
But so that, the coincidence of you both being there at the same time.
And I mean, I even still then, I was a person who wanted to be under the radar. I didn't really want to be noticed. But it was almost a kind of, those defences were irrelevant, you know, because we would interact and we would disagree so profoundly. And it became a bit of an in-joke that anything that was talked about, we would be on opposite sides. Yeah, and we from being friends with Sarah, I see it now, this is 5 or 6 years after that experience, that I changed my name from Steve White to Stefan Bianco.
Yeah.
And so this Stefan Bianco is a kind of way that Steve White doesn't get any of the impact. You know, he's had enough. Stefan Bianco is the person who can see these new things and maybe relay them and soften the blow a little bit.
Yeah.
That's in my head, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
But Stefan Bianco has been parented by three people. A feminist, a lesbian, and Colin.
Yay!
And
he'd love to be a lesbian feminist.
Yeah, he's probably all of them and more.
Yeah.
So anyway, those three people have taught me more in 6 years that I couldn't imagine anyone learning more and being pointed in the right direction and being patient with me when I'm you know, and because I am cantankerous and I'm obnoxious and my opinions are sometimes controversial, and they say, really, you know, so special, you know, so I don't want to leave Southampton.
How long have I known you then? How long have you been out of art school?
2010 I graduated.
Really?
I remember that you came to see my work.
Maybe 2009 or something?
I'd say that. Because I came to your shop in Oxford Street
for
my degree show costume, which
and we went and had a coffee, and it was May the 4th, because that's your sober day.
May the 4th be with you.
Yeah, I remember that. Mm. And so that's maybe, what was that, 4 years?
4 years, yeah.
So I've known you, I mean, not much less time than you've been in Southampton.
Mm. I moved to Southampton from Bournemouth because I couldn't afford to commute all the time. So,
isn't it funny?
Yeah.
All the little pieces of. I had model railway track in my mind, you know. Well, you know, because you connect that to a straight line, and then I've only got a bit that bends around that way. So now I've got to go that way, and now I'm going that way, and actually they all end you up on my sofa today.
Everything, all of them, all
mixed. Bloody hell!
Mm.
Crazy. Mm. My God, Steve, what a stonking conversation. I love your painting. I love the fact that you paint. I have one of your enormous accidental paintings in my house, which is much loved and appreciated. I'll take a picture of it and put it on the show's website so people can look at it. But I think this is conversation number 7 now. And with the greatest respect to all my other podcast guests, this is the most remarkable conversation I've had in quite some time.
Wow, I was only just getting started as well.
So I well, we've been chatting for quite a long time.
Oh my goodness.
So I'm going to say, Steve, you must be maybe come back again, and we'll talk about art another time.
Yes,
I thought we were going to maybe talk about art.
That's what I thought.
But
as
we
well.
Didn't quite get there, did we? We got on coming to art.
Which
but as you're someone who loves Martin Creed, and I also love Martin Creed, then I think that's the basis of a conversation.
It is, for sure.
So for now, I'm going to say, Steve White, thank you more than I can possibly say.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
To me today. Oh my God, Steve-o! So there you go, that was my conversation with my friend Steve White.
Just reflecting on listening to it through again, it's amazing, isn't it, how one kid can end up living a life where there's really no adults taking an interest, no school teacher, parents unavailable for various reasons, not an older brother and sister, not a neighbour. And so he was able to, his obvious intelligence and talents, both intellectual and sport and everything, just weren't able to get, you know, to be, the little sparks were not able to be fanned into flames. I think where he is and talking to him, and certainly the artistic expression that he now generates is a remarkable testament to a huge spirit inside a stocky man with a lot of hair and odd shoes. That's one of the features of Steve. You can tell him because he never wears matching shoes. So that was my conversation with Steve. I am in a position to tell you that next week's chat will be with Liz Carter. Liz, I met through a friend of a friend, and she has recently got into the wonderful world of triathlons. So she is passionate for the cycling and the swimming and the running, and it's brilliant fun to see how she's absolutely got herself carried away with all that. And we also do a little bit of sharing about what it is to be menopausal women. Don't worry, I won't freak you out too much, gentlemen, or perhaps even younger ladies who aren't even prepared to think about that yet. But yeah, it's good to share these big life experiences, so we do a little bit of chatting about that as well. So that's Liz Carter on next week's show. So, that was a long one today, wasn't it? But I think that conversation was worth it. Please keep in touch with the show. Our website is nobitspod.com. You can follow us on Twitter at nobitspod, or you can always find us on Facebook at smoothstylenobits, or via my Facebook page, Catherine Wright, if that's how you can reach me. Remember, please share it. If you find it on Facebook, just hit share, and nobody will judge you. But I really want to carry on growing this thing, because it's fun and it's exciting and the feedback I'm getting is really good. So, if I haven't expired through mental strain of trying to get my head round production spreadsheets, I will see you again this time next week. Take care, my chickadees. Bye.